You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Rob Schuler. Rob, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
So Rob, the way we start is with just kind of a big, broad question. Who are you? And that's kind of your opportunity to paint a picture, stories, labels, qualities, whatever you want to kind of let us know where we need to start this conversation.
Great. Thank you. I guess I would say I'm a student turned activist, and that's actually the reason why I still live in Ithaca. And I came here originally because of Cornell and fell in love with the Ithaca community. But I love a lot of things. I love music. I love writing. I love nutrition and agriculture, and everything's kind of led me towards what I'm doing today. So that's great.
And so you're an academic activist.
Yes.
And what other labels do you wear? Whatever the other.
Yes, I think I try to be an uplifter, and there's so much out there that people aren't aware of that I have become aware of in just a few short years that would really help everyone out, I feel, and and if they choose to go down that route. And so I just try and promulgate everything that I come across that would help individuals or humanity as a whole.
Right. Yeah, so you strive to be generous.
Yeah. I try to be. Things work better, I think, when I've noticed, at least, when when I don't hold back.
So that's a great image to start with. Now, you brought some music.
Yes.
And do you want to say something about this first piece?
Sure. Yeah. Jay Dilla is one of my musical heroes, and a lot of people's musical heroes. He's actually no longer with us. He passed on in 2006 from a very rare blood disease. And I feel he's kind of the last great kind of musical icon that historic American musical figure. He really was, he was a hip hop producer, and he really is probably the most influential hip hop producer now, and it's just a stellar musician. And
okay, so we will go CI Master.
Thank you.
was J. Dilla and CI Master, and only about 3 minutes of a 14-minute version. Our guest, you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rob Schuler. So Rob, can you tell me about some of the experiences that have shaped who you are now, that have kind of led you to this role of an academic activist and a person who is trying to be one of uplift and generosity?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I came to Ithaca several years ago.
Where'd you come from?
California, mm-hmm. The Bay Area is where I grew up. I grew up in San Jose, California. Yep. Born in 1990, so right at the time when it was really taking off and becoming a huge metropolis. Mm-hmm. And my whole family grew up there essentially for the last generation and a half or so. And it was a great environment. My dad always said that, you know, we won the lottery, you know, being able to be born in the Bay Area, California, and go to school there and everything. And yeah, I was very curious, you know, growing up, and would read everything I got my hands on, and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that kind of translated into, oh, well, you should be good at school, you should be studying, and that.
Right.
And I took that and ran with it, and just put a lot of energy forth into, you know, jumping through the hoops and doing, getting the good test scores and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. everything. And knew I wanted to, you know, college was going to be a big thing for me. It was a big focus for me. And
were your family academics or
they weren't actually, they were not academics. My dad and my mom both had some limited college, very limited.
So you're the first generation to complete.
Yeah. Well, I had older siblings too, first generation. And, they were very bright though. Mm-hmm. They really, and my dad is kind of a genius kind of figure, eccentric. And, and he was a woodworker, or he is a woodworker, master craftsman, carpenter, civil engineer, and he builds guitars as well,
luthier.
Luthier, exactly. Yeah. And so he really just pushed me to go as far as I could, mm-hmm. In my life. And that led me to getting into Cornell.
Uh-huh.
And
why Cornell?
Well, it's actually pretty funny. I was actually also a football player in high school. I was really, those are my two, academics and athletics were my big, uh-huh. football and track. And
California has a funny football system though, yeah, compared to the rest of the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's unique. Yeah, and it's I'm glad I was a part of it. It was uh-huh. it was fun. But we had a very funny team. We were pretty poor our first couple of years, in terms of when I was a freshman, sophomore, and junior, and then we really clicked, and we had a great head coach who was very inspirational for me, and uh-huh. and we went undefeated our senior season, uh-huh. which was unprecedented for our, you know, our school is not a football school, so right. it caught everyone by surprise, including us. So that was very memorable and fun. But my coach forced me essentially to apply to all the Ivy League schools, it wasn't even in my field at that time. I knew I wanted to go to a good school, but I had my eyes set on Berkeley, UC right. Berkeley.
Yeah.
And because it was closer to home, and I just...
State school.
Yeah, yeah. And I just really... I'd been there before. I'd done athletic things there before.
Why did he push?
He just... Well, I think deep down, he wanted me to play football for somewhere, and he knew I was the academic of the team or uh-huh. whatever. And he... He said if I could play football for a school like that, it would be the best shot that I had. And even if I couldn't play football for a school like that, then just going there and attending would still be the best.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I really wasn't set on playing football in college or anything like that.
Right.
But interestingly enough, I'd gotten into Berkeley, and I didn't get into Stanford. But Berkeley, which were my two main schools that I was applying to. And Berkeley, you know, the UC system back then and still, I think, was so broke, you know,
right.
financially. And
right.
so they did not give me much financial aid at all. And that was a real bummer. And that was a time when I was just living with my mom alone.
Right.
My parents had separated, and my older brother and sister were already in school. And we didn't have any money, and we didn't get any financial aid, and it was just a kind of a frightening situation.
And the California decisions are really early, so you probably knew that really early.
Yeah, they're a bit earlier, and And then I had totally forgotten that I had applied to all these other schools that my coach made me. And by happenstance, I got a package from Cornell, and I was accepted in Cornell. And I didn't know much about Cornell at the time, really at all. But everyone else, all the adult figures in my life did, and they were very congratulating.
Yeah.
And in part of that package was, it was the first year that Cornell decided to give 100% need-based financial aid, which means it was by far the cheapest choice for me and my family. Yeah,
you're pushing buttons with my family too, because I got a scholarship to Cornell in 1976. I got my whole way paid, basically. I had to work study, but back then they still did 100%. They went through a period of time where they had a lot of loans in it, but they added this kind of, there are people who shouldn't have to have loans.
And so I
really didn't, except for when I took a leave of absence one semester.
And
my older brother had a football story.
Yeah.
He got a scholarship to Harvard.
Wow.
And that was his ticket out. And he played 1 year, got injured, and never played again.
Oh,
but it was an education. Did you ever play football for Cornell?
No. I kind of completely let that go over at the last half of my senior year in high school.
Uh-huh.
Sure. And I was pretty, to be honest, I was pretty depressed when the football season ended. It was such, I had kind of done everything academically, and, you know, high school was, I went to a public school. It wasn't the most challenging of schools, and I had kind of jumped through all the hoops academically that I needed to.
You probably found some challenges of your own to take.
Yeah, exactly. But honestly, athletics was my main focus the last couple of years of high school, because there's just nothing else for me to do, and it was fun being a leader of that system, and just being part of a family, so that's how I got led to Cornell, and it was, I'm very grateful for the opportunity. It really helped my mom and I out, and so that's how I first came to Ithaca. And
so what did you find here, and what keeps you coming back?
Well, yeah, so it's my, I did 2 years at Cornell.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't stand any minute of it.
What were the issues? Because I left after, I had a really good first semester, and then everything was a disaster for 3-4 semesters, and I left.
Sounds like we have a similar
fifth semester.
Yeah. Well, I had never visited Cornell or came here or anything. I'd never set foot on campus before. Yep. My mom and I came here when she dropped me
with
off.
With your suitcases and your whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was, I just never, from the first time I was on campus, I just never really felt at home. There was something in the air that I could feel, and it was, I made friends, but the connections were very different from what I was used to, and the culture shock was very different. And I gotta say, I spent most, just because I didn't have a car or anything, I spent most of my time on campus, and it became just this kind of little black hole of, I was just not happy. I was totally, and, you know, a big part of it was me too, and I was, you know,
homesick.
I wasn't bitter. Yeah, homesick, yeah. And wanted other things in life. I felt that I shouldn't be dealing with these winters, you know, at this time of my life.
Right.
And doing this. And I was very, you know, I wasn't very grateful for the experience. And, so I did 2 years. And during that time was a time of heavy Cornell suicide.
Yeah.
And it was when it was making nationwide news on CNN. And
so was 76 through 78 when I was here as a student. That was one of the first big peaks that caught a lot of news.
Yeah.
But no, it affects your attitude.
Yeah, it was the heaviest atmosphere I think I'd ever felt on campus, and everyone felt it. And that's kind of when I felt terrible. I wasn't suicidal per se, but I was like, I think I gotta get out of here. And so I took a leave of absence and
How long did you go away for?
I left. Well, it's funny. I took a leave of absence, quote unquote, but pretty much so I didn't freak my mom out, right? Uh-huh. But I was never planning on coming back, to be honest.
Right.
And I left, and at that point, I had started getting into nutrition and agriculture, sustainable agriculture, and I was studying that for hours a day on my own time, and that led to a lot of opportunities when I left Cornell and Ithaca. to where I was gone for almost 4 years, actually.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I did a couple of seasons. I worked for a really famous naturopathic doctor, Gabriel Cousins, and he has a veganic farm, mm-hmm. and all sorts. He's into all sorts of fields.
Part of Norm Cousins' dynasty.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah.
He was the guy who popularized vitamin C back in the '70s.
I don't think so. But I'm sure they're familiar. I don't know. Maybe they're familiar with each other.
He died a number of years ago. But he was one of his first people trying to figure out how you treat yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. But I basically went and worked for him, kind of interned for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to a job with him where I was actually working directly under him, which was really fascinating. And I felt I learned more with him in a year than I did in my whole secondary education.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a rapid time of transformation for me.
Right.
And through there, I just bounced around and just kept doing agroecological work and research and working on various farms with, you know, organic farms, advanced agroecological mm-hmm. techniques, and kept on studying and kept on applying. And I did some traditional school here and there, community colleges, and I think I sat in on some UC Berkeley classes too. I actually relocated up there for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And just really became a radically different person because I felt I had lost, this might be overdramatic, but I felt I had lost everything. You know, I had completely, this goal that I had my whole life of attending a prestigious university just collapsed underneath my feet.
Right,
and I just wanted more substance.
I want to go back, and this may not be where you want to go, so tell me.
Oh, fine, that's fine.
But for me, when I came to Cornell, mm-hmm. I had a lot of friends, and I ran for back then the university senate actually controlled a large portion of the budget.
Wow.
So I ran for that, and I won, and I was and had very wonderful out the gate start. But I took very small courses and few of them because I knew it would be a huge transition from a rural Midwestern school.
Yeah.
But I discovered, and I had these friends, but I felt a little bit like the naif, the kind of the relatively poor. I had a kind of a Midwestern rural kind of nasal accent, and I had to learn that I had to ditch a lot of that kind of stuff to fit in.
Yeah.
I had more in common with the housekeepers and the building staff than I did with the students or the faculty.
Yeah.
So it was a total alienation. And by the time I got into big courses, my second and third semesters, I was lost.
Yeah.
There was just no finding. It was the dream was like crazy for me.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering when you said you didn't quite fit, you didn't find the people. I was wondering what was your experience of the people?
Very similar coming from, California. And
and a working class family.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Bay Area is a unique place, just like the Midwest is, you know,
sure,
and
sure.
So you definitely, although Cornell is very multifaceted with the students that come there, it still is very traditional and very, you know, it's still a New York school.
It accepts a lot, but it doesn't necessarily include them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a very, and it makes people change, and mm-hmm. a lot of people do make the change, and they're happy with that, and a lot of people, such as myself and yourself, just don't really want to make that shift to be a successful Cornell, not successful academically, but just successful in the terms of connecting with everyone and being part of that community.
And for some of it, I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to approach people or how, even though I had jobs working as a research associate, and I didn't have to work in dining, which was like a big thing, but I still didn't know how to socialize.
Yeah. And for me, it was interesting because high school was really a time where I was always kind of secluded and reclusive. And high school was a time for me where I really came into my own and made a lot of friends, and it was easy to socialize and connect, which was kind of new to me. And when I came to Cornell, it was a totally different set of rules, and I kind of felt I was regressing becoming something that I didn't want to become. Again, none of this reflects on Cornell, I guess, but it does.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And what I want to say is that it's, it's a big institution.
Yeah.
It has a culture, and not all cultures and not all people fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And finding how to navigate our way through that in life. I mean, for me, I tried it one fifth semester, and I dropped out before I flunked out.
Yeah.
I took a leave because I could see the writing. But what I said to myself was, for me, I am going to figure this out.
Yeah.
So I continued to live in an apartment with four other Cornell students.
Yeah.
And I just observed how they coped doing what I couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent the next 9 months before I decided to go back and start again, because I only took 9 months off. But it was enough for me to say, I can do this. It wasn't enough for me to get clarity about vocation, which you seem to have done. And so when you left Cornell, you left the area.
Yes. Yeah, I left the area, and
you left under some pressure because you weren't doing so well.
Yeah, yeah, and I absolutely, and again, it just was not a, my family wasn't, they were supportive, but it was definitely a, an air of what's going on, what's happening here,
right.
why can't you just make this work, kind of thing.
Right. Like the show In the Heights.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a little bit the same story mm-hmm, for a Latina, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. But I left, and it was very transformative. I had no idea where I was going, and it's amazing where I am today, which I guess we'll get to.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But it completely was birthed from that. That's like the phoenix, just complete destruction and from the ashes and so I just built myself an entirely new life and an entirely new belief structure and it's really. Served me well, and it's allowed me to finally. I feel like I'm finally my own person. I'm not doing things for other people.
Right.
I want.
Let's take a music break, and
sure.
We'll come back, and that's where we'll pick it up.
Absolutely,
is the life you've built for yourself. What should we go to next?
Let's do the James Brown Band, the JBs, Pass the Peas.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll be.
Here we go, and that'll be a lighthearted break.
Sure. Yeah.
Hey, Bobby, why do you like soul food?
Because it makes me. Happy.
Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Rob Schuler. So, Rob, when you left Cornell, kind of, as you said, kind of in the ashes of having kind of, it was not a dream, it was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. What is the life that you've put together that you're now so, that you're finding yourself?
Yeah. I just followed this strange string of just following what I was interested in and uh-huh. my passion and synchronicity. And
so when that heartbeat of passion kind of emerged from the ashes, where did you go?
Well, it was actually it had actually started
before.
Yeah, while it was crumbling.
Right.
Yeah,
oftentimes you cannot crumble until you have an alternative.
Exactly. So I felt terrible and just really physically unhealthy mm-hmm. and. I knew there was tons of mental and spiritual along with that as well, but I really became obsessed with the physical body and how to heal it and how to, you know, and that's when I actually became fascinated with a Cornell researcher, legend, T. Colin Campbell.
He wrote
the China Study, and he got me into the plant-based diet, which led to Gabriel's Place, and Gabriel was on another plane, you know, he was
Gabriel Cousins.
He's an American physician and medical mm-hmm. doctor, mm-hmm. but he did his residency in India. So he for 10 years he went to stay for a year and stayed for 10 years and just completely transformed. I'm sure like most of us, and so he's like a mystic, you know. He's kind of like a spiritual warrior, and he's very focused on getting people to heal the planet and eat mm-hmm. plant-based diets and do all these things. But he's really, you know, his main thing, which he kind of hides, is getting people to grow spiritually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's having people meditate, and he's basically simulated an ashram kind of lifestyle at his retreat, mm-hmm. But for an American audience and, you know, American clients and volunteers, and mm-hmm. so I was a volunteer, and just being in that atmosphere was just such an incredibly fertile ground for all sorts of stuff. So that got me into the agriculture and nutrition, and I didn't really have any focus or goals or what I wanted to do or, but I knew that I was on the right track, I guess you could say. And I knew that what I was doing felt right. And I was making incredible strides in my own health and mm-hmm. was becoming someone that I thought I would never become, just in terms of levels of health that I had achieved.
How were you the person you didn't think you'd become?
Well, you know, when I left Cornell, I felt very, very sick and just like no 20-year-old I should feel, you know, I had completely, you know, given up just huge patches of my anger and my resentment, which were kind of present along a lot of time. And there's actually a big physical connection to, like, you know, I got really interested in the liver, which is connected to anger in Chinese medicine. And it works, you know, when you really focus on this stuff. It really does. Yeah. Right. And
I dropped 40 pounds and I left, I left Cornell at 130. Yeah. No, that wasn't a good thing, because I went from normal weight to being almost ill, underweight.
So, yeah, both pressure. Of us actually. Yeah, yeah. Same thing. When I left, I looked like a ghost, and my family was extremely concerned. We have a very similar story.
And I found that I worked construction, and I worked with people coming off of the family, which was a commune, and they taught me how to meditate, and I took to it instantaneously, and that began to heal. To express my anger, I threw a cinder block.
Yeah.
I shot put it for like as many feet as I could, and I did that for as many repetitions as I could without hurting my body.
Yeah.
As a way to honor it, but not to indulge it.
Yeah. That's great. Wow. Yeah. And not hurt anything but a cinder block. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it didn't hurt it. It just kind of hurt the ground.
Yeah. 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 That's great. Wow. I didn't know our stories were similar.
I literally just met you.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from the group with. Here mm-hmm. in Ithaca.
Yes.
Then you learned about Gabriel Cousins.
Yes.
And that's when you went to pursue.
Yes.
That.
Yeah. And that led to, I'm still kind of I'm still on the path that he led me towards, mm-hmm. you know, and he doesn't force anyone to do anything, you know, he's just shows it open for anyone that wants to come.
This is an option.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm still working on things that he's, you know, he's so multifaceted and, mm-hmm. and, you know, he set me up for a lifetime of exploration in terms of nutrition and agriculture and all these things. And it really kind of, you know, I feel everyone kind of feel, especially these days in 2016, you know, people feel there's like a revolution occurring at almost every level of humanity. And whether it's mm-hmm. how we grow our food or how we express politics, or how we express journalism, there's kind of this alternative wave in every aspect of life. And he really kind of pushed me into that just at the right time mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And you know, as I'm glad I feel like I got on the plane that I needed to be on mm-hmm. for me to have a successful, fulfilling life that was authentic to me. And it was mainly because of him being who he was and what he did. And it was very inspirational. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and where did you go? Where next?
Yeah. So I did a lot of agricultural, I worked at similar farms, similar mm-hmm. agroecological kinds of venues.
Where were the farms?
A couple more close to Arizona and then a couple back home. You know, Santa Cruz is a big, mm-hmm. you know, and then I actually one of the coolest things I did was I worked for my aunt, and my aunts actually are this is kind of an orthogonal component to the story, but they started the first legal cannabis dispensary in Santa Cruz, uh-huh. and my family kind of relocated to Santa Cruz, and my mom worked for them, and it was actually her first job after my parents separated,
uh-huh.
and so they were right at the forefront of that movement, which has kind of taken over the whole United States right now, right?
Yeah.
And so I actually took a lot of what I had learned, and they have a property, and they grow medicinal cannabis on their property for their collective, essentially. Sure. And it's definitely, so I took a lot of what I had learned through organic farming and all sorts of little tips and tricks in that realm and applied it to their farm. And it was fascinatingly successful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were growing for this product, you know, this cannabis that we were growing was going towards all sorts of, and you know, results, and sure. we were doing a lot of, have you heard of CBD? We were doing, it's, you know, there's the kind of cannabis that when you imbibe it gets you high, so to speak,
right?
And that's the THC effect,
right,
which is important, and that's medicinal as well, and that's you know, that helps a lot of people out, and there's also the recreational aspect, of course,
sure.
of that.
Yeah.
And CBD is another cannabinoid. It's what they're, you know, the active constituent of cannabis.
What
does
CBD stand for? Because that's one I don't know.
I think it's cannabidiol, which is, so it's just a chemical name. And it's, so CBD is fascinating. It's a completely non-psychoactive version of cannabinoid.
Uh-huh.
But it's by far the most medicinal. And it's having tremendous success. It's,
in terms of people dealing with pain or...
Yeah, pain management is huge. It's famous for children with epilepsy and having seizures. And it's virtually the only thing that's able to consistently stop seizures in epileptic children.
And without side effects,
it works better than drugs. So people are actually pushing to pass it through Congress to where we need to legalize this just for the kids alone, right? Just for this one thing.
Just for this population.
Yeah. Sure. But it's, there's like a chart that's really famous for, you know, the medicinal benefits of various mm-hmm. cannabinoids. And, you know, THC does a couple things, and there's a couple other random cannabinoids that do a couple things. And mm-hmm. CBD is half the chart. It does everything all the other ones do and more.
Uh-huh.
You know, it stimulates bone growth, it gets rid of pain, stops seizures, good for your nervous system, good for, you know, anxiety, all these. So we were doing a lot of that. We were doing a lot of advanced extraction techniques. What I brought to the table was through Gabriel. He was really big on using ocean minerals on your crops, your organic crops, mm-hmm. which basically amounts to taking what is essentially seawater,
saltwater.
And you dilute it down, usually 100 to 1 in water,
right? Because you want to build the salinity of the soil.
Exactly. Yeah, and if you get the ratio just right, the salt actually acts as a mineral transporter, And
so it gets taken out with organic matter that you take away.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously, the seawater has every single element, and elemental molecule that you need for plant growth. And, you know, when we do industrial agriculture, you know, we're replacing nitrogen, potassium, you know, phosphorus, mm-hmm. these things, and not much else.
Right.
And so this is a way that we can, using the most abundant resource on the planet, ocean water, we can completely transform agriculture, and the nutrition goes through the roof, the vitamin C content is higher when you do this, all sorts of things go up. And so we started doing this with the cannabis, organic right. cannabis, uh-huh. and it was fascinating. It took the disease down, took the mildew down, there's no more yellow leaves, and the yield was better, the quality was better. So we were really producing really high quality medicine for mm-hmm. the community. And that's something I want. We were informally researching it. I want to, and we'll get into this. I want to research this stuff rigorously and mm-hmm. scientifically, and actually show that we can actually, you know, using this incredible resource that's available to all, we can transform all of agriculture. You know,
yeah, so take me from that job in Santa Cruz to where you are now.
Well, I. And it was great because I was living out on my aunt's property and in Bonny Doon, California, which is the mountains of Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. which was beautiful. And that was another very healing place for me.
Sure.
And yeah, so I don't know. I had done these years of random research, and it didn't really lead to any kind of career or anything. It just led to a bunch of fascinating, you know, discourse and study and all these things.
Right.
And I just felt the wind kind of blow me back to Ithaca for some reason. I can't really explain it. I just felt drawn to come back out to Ithaca and to Cornell mm-hmm. just to see what was going mm-hmm. on. And I decided to come back. I re-enrolled at Cornell and came back, and I was a little older and it was a little weirder, you know, that this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back to Ithaca.
You had a bigger reach this time around.
Yeah. Yeah. And I felt just much more myself and much more stable, and mm-hmm. and I just wanted to see where it would lead, and uh-huh. I came out with no expectations, because that's what really got me the first time, was expecting
right.
you know, something that I didn't get, and
not knowing how to deal with what you had.
Yeah, exactly. And so I came back out here, and a couple things started happening which was really interesting. Number one was, it was right from the start, when I came back, I immediately started attracting different people into my life,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in the Ithaca community. And I started to build a family in Ithaca that I had never had before.
And this was about 2013, 14?
This is, well, no, I
when you came
I got back?
Back,
I got back 2015. So, okay, yeah. So
so a year ago.
Yeah, a year and a half ago. And, I met my best friend in town I met her. And actually another fantastic friend of mine too. The first night I got back, I went to the bar at Moosewood to uh-huh, eat uh-huh. because I got back late from the train, and I couldn't get my key. And so I was like, oh, I'll go to Moosewood. It's my only familiar place that I know. And that's just, I just started attracting all these, amazing people and circumstances into my life, outside of Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of an Ithaca transplant now. I live here full time, and
right.
and I plan to stay, you know. And
and are you still a student back at Cornell?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. And I'd love to get into that, because I started back at Cornell, and immediately was, I was doing the work, but immediately felt all those kind of old feelings again, to a lesser degree, to where right. I was like, I don't know if I want to be doing this. I don't know if this is for me. I don't know if it ever was for me.
Right, right.
And then, I'd spent years just researching agriculture and agribusiness, and, and this debate between, organic and local small farms versus mm-hmm. industrial Monsanto S farms.
And there's also industrial organic. This is a whole
that's
other
true. Different. Yeah. So, and that's there's a lot of nuances to that.
There are also needs for scale.
Yes, absolutely.
Which we need to honor, whether they're small or large.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a lot of options that we have on all those realms, which is pretty great. And,
so back to your story. That's a
Yeah, well, this is fascinating. I came back to Cornell, and I started taking my classes, but sitting in on the agriculture classes at Cornell, just because I wanted to hear what was going on.
And what school were you in?
Well, I'm an arts and sciences student, okay. So just, you know, standard, you
yeah,
know.
I was good,
And
you sound like an ideal candidate for the College Scholar Program, but it's too late at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I think someone mentioned that, actually. Even similar story, yeah. But I sat in, and this is where my story leads me today, where I sit right now, and I sat in on a class entitled The GMO Debate, which was put on by CALS, the agriculture school at Cornell.
Right.
And I was thinking, oh, this is fascinating. You know, I know Cornell's had a little bit of history with the GMO thing. Right. And I'd, you know, I was obsessed with studying this, you know, for every night for, you know, a good part of a year and a half, 2 years or so. Right. And so I was like, okay, I assumed that this class would be people debating the pros and cons of genetic engineering in respect to agriculture.
Right.
And you know, kind of people you know, bringing a full palette of opinions and evidence.
Spectrum,
and,
palette, whatever metaphor you want to use.
Exactly, yeah. And it turned out that's not what happened in this class. It was 100% pro GMO, pro Monsanto talking point style. Yet it was called a debate class, right? So I'm sitting in this class, and literally it's only me who's raising my hand during the question and answer period at the end of these lectures, challenging what my professors were saying. Mm-hmm. And there were four professors in the class. It was called a university course, which, you know, multidisciplinary, you know, government and politics and science and, you know, all these different facets. And it was also put on by an organization called the Alliance for Science, which is a new organization at Cornell, which is intended to promote biotechnology above all else.
Sure.
And so I kind of became infamous in this class for protesting essentially what amounted to Monsanto talking points being passed off as rigorous academic discourse.
Right.
And I was very disgusted, to be honest with you, because I knew all the ins and outs of this debate. You know, I knew all the lies that people promulgate and all these, you know, I'm sure most of the Ithaca community is aware, but a lot of people aren't, that the GMO agriculture, as is currently being expressed today on the planet, was built on lies and deception and corporate control and greed, and it's not good. It's not good what's happening today. And I'm not making any claims of to what might happen with genetic engineering technology, whether it's going to be a benefit to humanity or not.
Right.
But the way we're doing it now is frightening. And so Cornell was basically subservient to the biotech industry. And so I was very, very frightened by what was happening on campus. And while I was taking the class, a Freedom of Information Act got released that connected all four of the professors, the head of the Alliance for Science, and the dean of CALS. They were all emailing Monsanto. That was the final nail in the coffin for me. That's when I realized, okay, here they're promoting 100% pro GMO.
Right.
Why would they do that when there's tons of evidence that, you know, the way we're applying GMOs is not good today? And then turns out that they're all emailing Monsanto. Right. It couldn't have been clearer that there was this was pretty corrupt, and it was, and I knew that that Cornell would take the pro GMO stance, you know, more than anything, but it was completely shocking how blatant this all was. So let me back up a little bit. I had met, like I was saying, I just kept meeting these interesting people, and I had met my hero, T. Colin Campbell, who started me off in this whole journey.
Right.
Who's Cornell, you know, he's a Cornell legend. He's been at Cornell for over half a century. And I met him very serendipitously, and another gentleman he was with by the name of Jonathan Latham, who runs independentsciencenews.org.
Right.
And meeting T. Colin Campbell was an eye-opening experience for me, because we developed a friendship, which was really great. And he started telling me about how his research had been completely maligned and dismissed by his own university because it conflicted with industry.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's advocate of plant-based eating, and Cornell's a huge dairy and meat school, and all these things, and So we sat down and talked for 2 hours at one point, and my jaw was on the floor just with all this kind of corruption and nonsense that was going on that I heard about at Cornell. And Jonathan Latham, the other gentleman I met, we developed a friendship as well. And he actually was the one that broke the story about the Cornell professors being connected to Monsanto.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And while I was taking the class.
Right.
And so we started working together, and I wrote an article about my experience mm-hmm. Of propaganda at Cornell. And I published it just a couple weeks ago. It got published on August 1st, so not just over a month ago. And it went, long story short, it went completely viral online. It got shared over a million times.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely, just it took on a life of its own.
Yep.
And what I documented in that article was kind of the propaganda that was being expressed to Cornell and what I was going to do about it and what I'm doing about it right now. And actually, it's just starting right now. So
mm-hmm.
I encourage everyone listening to come out. We're teaching our own independent course on GMOs at Cornell.
And who is we?
I am spearheading it as a student. And I have a couple other students that are helping me and working with me on this. And I, through Jonathan Latham and various others, I was able to bring in a fascinating collection of experts and scientists to come and be our lecturers for this series. And I'll just say it right now. It's every Wednesday night, starting this Wednesday coming up, the 7th of September, all the way till November 16th. Every Wednesday evening, 7 p.m., Annabelle Taylor Hall, upstairs auditorium at Cornell. And so we have so Jonathan Latham's giving a couple lectures on, you know, the Roundup Ready crops and mm-hmm. the BT crops. We have Allison Wilson, his partner, who's, they're both geneticists and scientists mm-hmm. and you know, doctorates, and she's gonna come and speak on how GMOs are made.
Right.
We have who else? We have Claire Robinson, who runs GMWatch .org, which is a hugely popular science-based look at genetic engineering, no propaganda, you know. We have a Frances Moore LePay, who a lot of people are aware of. She's actually, she can't come out, but this Wednesday, she recorded a special video video introduction just for our course.
Sure.
Yeah. So this whole project is going kind of viral because I don't think anyone's done anything like this before, which is actively protesting with evidence and education mm-hmm. and logic Monsanto's influence at Cornell.
Yeah. And is this a four credit course? Is it a non credit course?
This is a completely independent, completely non Cornell related. The only thing, it's held at Cornell because we were able to secure a building completely removed from Cornell. Right.
But you have no, like, if you had faculty sponsors, it could be independent studies.
It could, yeah. I actually haven't thought about that too much. People, but we're basically making free food for all the students to mm-hmm. come out to come enjoy a lecture on topics about GMOs that you won't hear about from Cornell because it goes against the grain.
Yeah, and there are some things. Cornell is withdrawing a lot of its support for meats, and that has changed. And that's not necessarily a good thing because the most efficient use of land often involves some meat production and meat and animal-based consumption
I agree, and I'd love to. This is
hugely complicated.
They're I'd love to talk. I could talk about this for a long time.
We'll take a break. Take a music break, but I want to come back to, this is a role that's highly unusual.
Yeah.
And I want to focus on that and what you do to take care of yourself in this role.
Sure.
For the next segment. What should we listen to next?
Let's listen to the Remember Shakti. Yeah, the John McLaughlin group.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rob Schuler. So Rob, this role of spearheading a course that's outside the academic mainstream at Cornell is quite unusual. Are you still an actively enrolled student while you're doing this, or
Not this
semester.
Yeah.
So you're taking the time to coordinate.
Yeah.
This semester.
I have 3 semesters left, and I'm 100% focused on this project this semester. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So how does taking this kind of a stand at odds with the kind of, and I wouldn't say this is so much a formal Cornell policy, is mm-hmm. that this is the way informal policy becomes the weight of an institution.
Yes.
So how does taking that on affect you as a human being, and what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, and physically to kind of bear this? Because this is the same problem you had the first time around.
Yeah.
It's just at a bigger scale.
Yeah. Well,
a much bigger scale.
Well put. And I got to say, this is all new territory for me.
Sure.
And but I feel much more grounded. The things that I did leading up to this, which I couldn't have predicted, have really led me to be much more stable and grounded just by default.
What is the default? What is stable and grounded to you now?
Well, I just, you know, I'm much more present, and I meditate, and I see people as connected, even people I disagree with, you know, I'm committed to living a life of just harmony, essentially, and even when it comes to disagreeing with people or going up against this machine, so to speak, I find it's really interesting, actually, and I'm just kind of thinking of this now, but this project went completely viral, like I mentioned,
mm-hmm,
and
sure.
I have all these email subscribers now, and this whole thing just blew up. But you know, rather than feeling kind of, you know, I would have predicted that I might have gotten like a little ego boost in this whole mm-hmm. transition, mm-hmm. and I kind of did, but more than anything, I just felt relieved that I was doing something about this.
Yeah, and you're not crazy.
I'm not crazy. Yeah, a lot of people think I am.
Well, but there can be elements of what you're doing that may not prove to be true, but they are grounded mm-hmm. in relationships that you can now trust.
Absolutely.
And when you step out and walk on that water,
yeah,
which is, and to use a Christian metaphor,
yeah,
because you don't know that you can do it until you do it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's there is a faith element to it, and I believe we're all internally guided, you know, mm-hmm.
When you use the word harmony, I would have gone for a slightly different phrase, because what I was hearing, you are not afraid of dissonance.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't mean we have to achieve harmony, because mm-hmm. whose definition of harmony? Because for some of us, it's chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's really interesting, because you know, I've gotten a lot of criticism for what I'm doing now,
mm-hmm.
Which is fine. But you know, I accept it, and I look and see if it's valid criticism or if it's baseless or whatever. Have you?
Or but if you don't know what to do with it yet, but just there are comments people mm-hmm. make to me. I file them in my head, and they'll come up 10 or 15 years later.
Absolutely.
And that person had something important to say to me, and I couldn't use it then.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But it's funny, you know, if I would have gotten criticism during the time when I was going through my rough Cornell years, it would have totally throw me for
devastated
a loop. Yeah, devastated me. And now it's amazing that I don't know why, just everything I've done has led to me to be more stable and more sovereign in myself, and just more, you know, I accept myself, and mm-hmm. I know that what I'm doing is not wrong, and I know that
and you may not know how it's right yet either.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah,
not
that's a good
wrong.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And again, this whole thing is not like an anti-GMO thing or anything. It's about academic freedom. It's about academic integrity and scientific mm-hmm. integrity, mm-hmm. which is sorely lacking at Cornell.
We confuse professionalism mm-hmm. and the seeking of professional status with knowledge.
Yes.
And what we have are mm-hmm. a bunch of guilds
mm-hmm.
that are producing people
yeah.
that mimic the guild.
Yeah.
And we need to find a way to address that.
Yeah.
That kind of, that collusion is what that's called. It's not outright. Yeah. It's not outright like running a mafia.
Yeah.
But being collusive is being complicit in all these ways we hide from each other.
Yeah. And I want to make sure. It very clear that I'm not placing, you know, I talked about my professors being connected to Monsanto. I'm making no claims about what that means.
Right.
I am saying that we know for sure that our professors are emailing Monsanto. Yeah. I'm not saying that they're taking money. I'm not saying that they're
that their judgment is being changed by that.
Yeah.
But it raises a question.
It raises a question, and as a critical thinker, when I look at the GMO arguments that are being made by these guys, and I know that many of them are very, from a factual basis, are not correct. For example, we need GMOs to feed the world. We actually don't. We have a food surplus in every sense of the word. And yet this is something that's just not true. And many...
We'll have to take the finer points later.
Because
I can see how this gets you going.
Yeah.
But I also see that there is a piece of humility in the conviction, because things may not prove as you suspect them to be, mm-hmm. but still you need to live your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so again, this is merely offering a different perspective that's not being rigorously offered on campus. But it's funny, you know, Cornell is kind of putting on this image that this is the, whether they intend to do this or not, they're kind of putting on this image that this is the official stance of what's going on at Cornell. You know, that this is science and this is agriculture and this is where the whole thing's headed. And there's tons of Cornell faculty and community members that are at odds with this belief.
Right. Yeah. And yes.
And the number, and I just gotta say, the number of, and I won't mention any names or anything, but the number of Cornell faculty and students and just Cornell community members that have reached out to me after I've started this project in favor of it has been profound.
Yes, yeah. I completely get it, and that would be wonderful. It has been wonderful to get to know you, Rob.
Absolutely, thank you so much.
And
likewise,
and we're going to close with a piece that you brought for us, George Harrison, Apple Scruffs. It's a great piece.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
Apple Scruffs.